the Gorgon Stare. Ross McNutt is the sort of entrepreneur who is, of course, former military. He has a company called Persistent Surveillance Systems, and he has been attempting to sell this technology all over the U.S.
The Gorgon Stare is a new aerial surveillance system named after the snake-headed Greek mythological sisters whose stares could turn a person to stone.
We don't have, you know, a functioning constitution in Germany anymore. It's basically a police state, right? Political opposition has been outlawed and demonized, and the cops are, you know, behaving like goon squads, running around, you know, beating the crap out of people. And the response to that is, the virus is real.
Max Blumenthal and C.J. Hopkins have both been censored for deviating from the received narrative about COVID-19.
Now we have the proof.
Mark Zuckerberg lied to users and the U.S. Senate about the privacy protection in WhatsApp.
If we were able to take control of our route instead of an algorithm, it would be safer and actually more cost-effective.
Algorithms that schedule work, Amazon deliveries, and Uber routes put workers at great risk. This is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In the 18th century, utilitarian philosopher Jeremy Bentham designed what he called the panopticon, a type of institutional building and system of constant surveillance and control. Although Bentham focused primarily on his design for a prison, he argued that his basic plan was equally applicable to hospitals, schools, sanatoriums, and asylums. The concept of his design is to allow all prisoners of an institution to be observed by a single security guard, without the inmates being able to tell when they are being watched. This, he said, would compel them to behave as though they were being watched all the time. Bentham never saw a panopticon built in his lifetime, but a number of prisons have since incorporated panopticon elements into their design. Michel Foucault revitalized interest in the panopticon in his 1975 book, Discipline and Punish. The panopticon prisoner is seen, he wrote, but he does not see. He is an object of information, never a subject in communication. The panopticon has since become a metaphor for widely encompassing surveillance systems, some of which we'll consider today. In June 2021, a federal appeals court ruled that the surveillance planes flying over Baltimore were an unconstitutional violation of the Fourth Amendment. After that, the Capitol Police in Washington, D.C. announced that they were opening field offices in San Francisco and Tampa, and that the Defense Department had given them use of 8 spy planes. These wide-angle surveillance planes were used in Fallujah during the Iraq War. They are referred to as the Gorgon Stare because they provide a picture of most of a city at one time, and combined with street-level surveillance, can pretty much track anyone's movements. I spoke to Tracy Rosenberg, coordinator of Oakland Privacy and executive director of Bay Area-based Media Alliance, about this new form of surveillance. Tracy, can you tell us more about this new surveillance technology?
Sure. The Gorgon Stare, which is also referred to by some as the eye in the sky, are basically small airplanes that fly over an area with large cameras attached to the bottom and basically show you a wide-angle panoramic view of anything and everything that is going on the ground underneath. Now, the way the technology is developed so far, basically what you see is a series of pixel-sized dots that represent vehicles or people walking down the street. However, when this is combined with other kinds of surveillance that is down on the street level, like closed circuit cameras or automated license plate readers or outdoor microphones, what have you, there's an ability to specifically track movements in real time across the span of an entire metropolitan area.
So this is an example, again, of a military technology being turned to domestic application, right?
Absolutely. And there is an ongoing flood of technology that comes off of the battlefield and is slightly, and not even all that much sometimes, repurposed for the purpose of being sold to local police. In the particular case of the Gorgon Stare, Ross McNutt is the sort of entrepreneur who is, of course, former military. He has a company called Persistent Surveillance Systems, and he has been attempting to sell this technology all over the U.S. We did a public records request, and several cities came up with proposals, requisitions, RFPs, although it has not been deployed yet in anywhere but the city of Baltimore.
Okay. Shouldn't the decision of the Federal Appeals Court regarding the Baltimore application make this illegal in Washington, San Francisco, and Tampa?
You would think that it would. I mean, it's certainly a blow to Persistent Surveillance Systems and Ross McNutt's attempt to monetize this surveillance technology in a broad way. The original Baltimore effort was actually funded by a foundation, the John Arnold Foundation, John and Laura Arnold Foundation, based out of Texas, but they have now sort of seen the light and decided they are not willing to continue paying for this technology's expansion. In terms of the court decision in Baltimore, it applies to the Baltimore PD. Potentially, it also applies to other local law enforcement agencies, but at the moment, it does not apply to the operations of the federal government. That said, it may have some precedential impact, but further litigation would be required to address both the use by the feds and also, of course, the use by the U.S. government in other countries.
So this is a technology that was banned for municipal use in Baltimore, but this is a federal application, even though it's in San Francisco and Tampa, as well as Washington, D.C.
Yes, the Capitol Police, they are supervised by the Congress of the United States as a sort of intelligence agency. What happened is, in the wake of the events on January 6th, the Capitol Police asked for and received a significant amount of additional funds and additional authority to deliver on their mission of protecting Congress. And among the other things that happened is they were authorized to open two field offices, one in California, which will be based in San Francisco, and one in Florida, which will be based in Tampa. And also, they were given by the Defense Department 8 of the Persistent Surveillance Systems planes, which are equipped with the wide-angle surveillance cameras. So it is our expectation that those planes will be used by the Capitol Police. Apparently, the Department of Defense is going to train them on how to use them, and then they will basically become the property of the Capitol Police. So we are potentially looking at these planes, which have been found unconstitutional by an appeals court, flying potentially over San Francisco and Tampa and other areas under the auspices of the Capitol Police. It's very upsetting.
And this is supposed to be justified by some idea of domestic threat?
The Capitol Police's jurisdiction, as it were, is specifically threats to federal politicians, to members of Congress. So in theory, all of this is sort of justified for the protection of the 435 members of the U.S. Congress specifically.
Will it have police applications in San Francisco and Tampa?
What we're basically talking about is a form of mass surveillance that will impact pretty much everyone where these planes are flown, in order to protect a simple handful of people. And another sort of concerning aspect of this is that the Capitol Police have been authorized basically to participate in all kinds of law enforcement sharing arrangements, which include data sharing agreements. So they'll have access to local law enforcement information, they'll have access to FBI files, and they'll be collaborating with all of these entities. So it's basically sort of another form of federal police that will become very active both in San Francisco and Tampa and the surrounding areas. And we have always found that when there are active data sharing agreements with local police and federal entities, that the federal entities become involved with helping local police do their local police stuff. So I think we can safely assume that this equipment and this technology, which again has been ruled unconstitutional, will eventually play some role in law enforcement operations. We have a term in the surveillance and privacy community called mission creep, which is sort of what it sounds like, which is basically the idea that if the thing that the surveillance technology is specifically for is not active at any given moment, you can pretty much assume that because it's there, it will be repurposed to whatever law enforcement is working on at the time. And we see no reason why that probably wouldn't happen, because basically you've got a number of planes on the ground and they're going to be used for something.
Your work is in large part organizing resistance to this sort of thing. What's the state of the resistance to this?
It's interesting. We put together an action alert when we heard this information as kind of Oakland Privacy. And we wrote to the Capitol Police. We wrote to Zoe Lofgren of San Jose, who is a congressperson who is actually the chair of the committee that supervises the Capitol Police. And we wrote to San Francisco's mayor, London Breed. We sent, 500 or 600 electronic appeals, basically expressing concern about this. And we haven't heard a thing. No response back. And I think that the problem here is, as with any act of terrorism, in the wake of January 6th, it becomes an excuse to do things that would be totally unacceptable in any other environment, but somehow post January 6th are kind of okay. So in a way, we are replicating a lot of the mistakes that were made after the World Trade Tower fell down in September 11th. 2001, which is basically saying it's okay, something bad happened, therefore we can sort of throw out all of the normal cautions and just sort of wildly proceed because it's an emergency and therefore we can do anything that we want.
Which was pretty predictable in both cases. It seems like surveillance technologies just keep getting worse and more prevalent. We have several stories about them in this show, which is about censorship and surveillance. Do you see any reason to be optimistic about it?
Well, one piece of good news was certainly the decision in Baltimore. It's important to say that, number one, the planes had already been taken out of the skies. But of course, the lawsuit continued. And after the use of the planes had been upheld, both on the lower court level and on the appeals court level, it was brought back for reconsideration by an unbanked panel, which is sort of a secondary appeal process. And that appeals court ruling, which came out about a month ago, is probably one of the most, I don't want to say anti-surveillance, but one of the most constitutionally accurate rulings that have probably ever come out of the U.S. court system. It is a really strong defense of Carpenter versus United States, and an extremely strong defense of the concept of an unconstitutional search and seizure that is found in the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. So I do take a lot of heart at that court ruling. I think it's extraordinary. And I think when it comes to these particular planes, unfortunately, we are probably going to, and this is often the case with surveillance, have to wait until this technology is misused, which it will be. And then at that point, the resistance will have to tamp up. Unfortunately, and we go through this all of the time, we're told that surveillance equipment will be used in very limited ways with discretion and restraint. And it never is. But when you're at the beginning phase of the process, those statements or those assurances that are given to the public essentially have to be proven wrong before you can get political traction to make something stop. So unfortunately, we are probably in the position that we will have to wait for this equipment to be used when it shouldn't be used in order to make the case that it needs to be taken out of the skies.
Are there any more lawsuits underway?
Not that I'm aware of, but it is not impossible that someone will file one. Again, I think in this case, it will likely happen after this equipment is deployed on the ground when there is evidence that it is not being used for the purpose intended.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
Well, I think it's important to say that this is just another example of the ways in which the private surveillance market, heavily impacted by the U.S. military, is basically looking to exploit current events to make money, because we have a situation here where basically ex-military is selling us solutions to crime and terrorism, and public money is basically pouring out for all of these various contraptions. What we have here is a surveillance system that largely just shows you pixels. Those pixels have to be converted into meaningful intelligence. And so it's basically a whole lot of fundamentally useless information that is being collected more for the sake of being collected than being actually able to take any sort of actions to prevent something from happening. And this is an ongoing problem with surveillance. Basically, we decide that we want to collect all of the information first, and whether it works or whether it's helpful or whether it actually does anything, we kind of look at afterwards. And, you know, this is another situation where, whoa, we can get all of this info. What are we going to use it for? Well, we'll figure that out later.
So it's an experiment as much as anything else at this point.
I think that's right. I think that's entirely correct. And unfortunately, the urban areas of the United States are right lined up after Fallujah as a place where they can try all these gizmos out.
Okay, Tracy Rosenberg, thank you for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Tracy Rosenberg, coordinator of Oakland Privacy and executive director of Bay Area-based Media Alliance. That was Somebody's Watching Me by Rockwell and Michael Jackson. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In a recent conversation on the Rockfin podcast, Foreign Agents, journalist Max Blumenthal and playwright, author, and essayist C.J. Hopkins talked about the censorship they both faced for deviating from received narrative about COVID-19.
So what happens in 2015, 2016... okay, there's no outside ideological enemies anymore, but what happens is you get this internal populist rebellion, and it starts popping up in Europe, and it starts popping up in the UK, and it starts popping up in the US, and it actually elects Donald Trump president, which is a problem, right? And so GlobalCap says, we need to put this populist rebellion down, and we need to teach these people a lesson. Right. And the lesson is, we're in charge. You vote for who we tell you to vote for, and you don't vote for unauthorized ass clowns and you don't leave the European Union. And basically, we're running the show, we're in charge, and you all will toe the line, or you'll pay the price, bringing us back to the new normal. The rollout of the new normal, which I really do see as a new form of totalitarianism. It is not, you know, the 20th century totalitarianism. They're not going to be jackboots and big banners and Riefenstahlian, you know, spectacles and what have you. It is a new form of totalitarianism. It's global capitalist totalitarianism, and it is being rolled out in response to this internal populist uprising, right? Globocap, the way I see it, Globocap, for whatever reasons, and I think people are digging into all of those, has decided, you know what, it's time for us to go a little bit more totalitarian, right? We need to clamp down on society, and we need to have a structure in place that will allow us to control people a little bit more directly, right? And this is exactly how I saw the rollout of the new normal from the very beginning. If you go back, I just retweeted them the other day. I retweeted my initial interminable thread from March and April of 2020, and it was all there right at the beginning. The lockdowns came, the police were in the streets, they were beating up women in Paris for leaving their house without permission. The robot dogs came out. They were already talking about vaccine passports and mandatory vaccines.
Drones and helicopters telling people to get back inside, and hard censorship, hard online censorship.
Absolutely. And it was all rolled out at once. And it wasn't rolled out secretly. They came out and announced it. I'm talking March of 2020. They came out and said, your life is about to change forever. We're going to, you know, society is going to be radically altered, and it's going to be permanent because of a coronavirus, which, and it's hard to say that now because people are so deep into the narrative, into the ideology, but the absurdity, Max, just the absolute insanity of believing, okay, we have to radically alter the fabric of human society, right? Because of a coronavirus. It's madness. And they rolled it out. They announced it right in the beginning.
Yeah. And there were, prior to the declaration of a dangerous novel coronavirus or a pandemic, several simulations that were run by two of the organizations that are directly behind what is known as the science. I mean, you look at the doctors, the public health officials who are active in generating the narrative. You look at the information war to generate a climate of fear. These two organizations are completely honeycombed within that apparatus. I'm talking about the Rockefeller Foundation, which is a traditional CIA cutout, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Rockefeller Foundation ran a simulation called Operation Lockstep about a pandemic and a authoritarian or totalitarian response, which would be sort of reflexive, and how should societies respond. And then there was Event 201 by the Gates Foundation. And so much of what we saw in those simulations has become the program grafted on to half-wit big city mayors like Bill de Blasio. They had gamed this out from the beginning. I think it's why so many people get conspiratorial about COVID-19's origins, which remain a mystery. And this was clearly a blueprint conceived, and I'm talking about the program, the system, not the virus, by global capitalism, what you call Globocap, prior to the introduction of the pandemic. And I also remember when the lockdown began in the United States, we were all treated to a concert with Yo-Yo Ma and all of these famous musicians. And at the end, Bill Gates comes on screen and with Melinda Gates and said, thank you everyone for staying home. We're working on a solution and we're going to take care of it. This guy who has no medical degree, I don't even think he graduated from college. He spent, I think, more time with Jeffrey Epstein than he did in any science lab. And he is responsible for telling us that everything's going to be fine. I want to bring on screen something that you wrote that really signals during the lockdown where things were going in a truly disturbing way. And you got censored for posting this. You got censored simply for posting a photograph of something that was real. And it's this Impfen frei equals Freiheit. This was in Berlin. Here's your Facebook post. Vaccination equals freedom. Not quite Arbeit macht frei, but close enough. And so basically Germans, correct me if I'm wrong, were in lockdown and were being told that they could be free if they took a emergency use vaccination.
Basically, it's just part of the massive propaganda campaign that we've been subjected to here in Germany. And Germany is not unique. The same thing has happened in the UK. As far as I can tell, the same thing has happened in the United States. But I live here in Berlin, and so I've experienced it here. And it is just the most frightening propaganda event I've ever seen in my life. The censorship was instant. I mean, in Germany, they abrogated the constitution and they passed the Infektionsschutzgesetz, allowing the government to basically rule by decree. They had banned all political protests against the coronavirus measures. All other protests are fine, but anyone that is challenging the official ideology, that's outlawed now, that's banned, and the police come out and beat the crap out of you if you try to engage in it. This photo...
Here's the removal of your post. Your post goes against our community standards on dangerous individuals and organizations. So we define dangerous as things like terrorist activity, organized hate or violence, serial murder. This is being likened to Jeffrey Dahmer, human trafficking. I mean, everything. So just you posting that, which was there for everyone in Berlin to see, got flagged on Facebook. I can't have this conversation on YouTube. It will be taken down for the same reason, just to merely have this conversation. The censorship is out of control. Forbes just published a very thoughtful piece on masking children and the psychological damage it can do to them. The UK is not masking children in schools, nor is the Netherlands, so it shouldn't be that controversial. The editors removed it without explanation. I mean, it's happening all over. I've never seen any censorship like this. And I got to say, a lot of my leftist friends who've been concerned about the censorship of, I don't know, Venezuelan public officials who are under sanctions just simply because the U.S. is sanctioning them, or Palestine solidarity speech, are silent on this.
Yeah, the censorship is insane. And Max, I think one of the most dangerous things about it, what I've noticed, is that it has been so intense for so long now, a year and a half, that people have become accustomed to it. And it is largely not seen as an aberration anymore. It has become normalized to an extent that people, when I post things on social media and people write in to advise me, oh, you can't post it that way because they'll censor it. So you have to post it this other sneaky way, not say what you mean, and so on and so forth. And they're advising me of this, like someone explaining to a guest in your house, it's like, oh, the toilet handle, you have to jiggle it a little bit to get it to work. We're losing our outrage at the fact of this type of censorship. And that is really, really scary to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are unable to even express much outrage about the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from leadership around the world. I'm going to play a clip for you that got me attacked as someone who wants people to die, who is an anti-vaxxer, basically worse than an anti-Semite. This was one of the first times I was really attacked. After watching this, you can respond, but I also want you to address the mob mentality, because I want to get into your latest post about the ideology, the new normal ideology.
Don't talk to your neighbors. Stay local and do not congregate. Don't talk to your neighbors. Please keep to your bubbles. It comes down again.
I want to play that again.
And do not congregate. Don't talk to your neighbors.
Don't talk to your neighbors.
Please keep to your bubbles.
Keep to your bubbles.
It comes down again to those very simple principles. We know from overseas cases of the Delta variant that it can be.
So that set off alarm bells for me. Don't talk to your neighbors. Stay in your bubbles, regardless of what they're doing with their lockdown. And then you just look at the comments on me posting just that clip. And I characterized it slightly and I said, you know, you should only interact on carefully surveilled online channels, which is kind of the obvious implication. But I was just, viciously attacked and people were saying, I want people to die. So if you have any reaction to Jacinda Ardern, who's kind of like the squad, she's like the global version of the squad that we have here in Congress, and her comments and the ritual stoning that people like you have experienced for the past year or so.
Yeah, it's been a year and a half. It's like, I'm sorry for smiling, but it's just people have been explaining to me that I'm killing people with my words for, 18 months. You mentioned my recent piece, which was the third part of a series called The COVIDian Cult, comparing the new totalitarianism, the new normal totalitarianism, to a cult. And that really is my experience. And from what I gather from, responses that I get, it's the experience of quite a lot of people trying to talk to people who completely believe the narrative, or even just posting things like what you posted, or just posting, that picture of the tower that I posted. The other day, I won't mention any names, I posted a picture of a bunch of cops in Berlin. It was a year after that first big protest. And so the anniversary protest had been announced. And of course, the German authorities outlawed the protest. They banned it. And tens of thousands of people still came to Berlin and gathered and protested and went through the streets. And the cops beat the crap out of them and occupied the city and fenced off the Central Park and the government district and all of this. I posted a picture of this on social media saying nothing about the virus, just saying, look at what we're doing to society. This is the state in Berlin, right? The city's occupied, the government district is fenced off, the park is shut down, and the police are beating the crap out of people. And I got a response from a friend of mine, an old colleague of mine, who wrote back and said, I know somebody who died, right? Of COVID, of course. And I wrote to him and I asked him, why would you respond to my post about this totalitarian manifestation in my city? Why would you respond to that post by telling me about somebody who died of COVID, right? If you think about that for a second. But this is the mentality that has been generated and has been created. Simply me posting and saying, hey, we don't have, a functioning constitution in Germany anymore. It's basically a police state, right? Political opposition has been outlawed and demonized. And the cops are, behaving like goon squads running around, beating the crap out of people. And the response to that is the virus is real.
Yeah. I get the same thing just for pointing out Australia's building massive quarantine centers that will mostly be for travelers from the global south, that Australia now has a facial recognition app that returning travelers have to download, and then they have to submit themselves to random tests where they have to prove that they're at home within 15 minutes of the test, or police will be summoned to their home. People have to post signs on their home that they are under quarantine if they're not in the quarantine centers. Australians have to ask permission to leave, and people will respond to that. And Australia is a Five Eyes nation. It's not an outlier. It's a laboratory. It's the zero COVID laboratory. And then when zero COVID fails, they'll say, we need to go under lockdown and whatever. They'll do something else extreme.
That was an excerpt of Max Blumenthal and CJ Hopkins' more than hour-long conversation on Blumenthal's new podcast, Foreign Agents. This is the sixth episode of the podcast on the Rockfin platform, rockfin.com. That was Computerwelt by Kraftwerk. Next, Nick Espinoza, chief security fanatic at Security Fanatics and producer of the Pacifica podcast, Nick's Nerd News, talks about how Mark Zuckerberg lied to WhatsApp users and the U.S. Senate about WhatsApp privacy.
Hey everybody, Nick Espinoza, your chief security fanatic here. I want to talk about Facebook-owned WhatsApp.
WhatsApp is a great company, and it's a great fit for us.
Because we now have proof that WhatsApp isn't private. And I've been talking about this for years, but thanks to great reporting by Peter Elkind, Jack Gillum, and Craig Silverman at ProPublica, now we have the proof. And here's what's going on. So, let's go back to 2019. Mark Zuckerberg unveiled a quote-unquote new privacy-focused vision for Facebook. He cited the company's global messaging service, WhatsApp, basically a secure end-to-end encrypted model that we will talk about very soon. He cited WhatsApp as essentially the model for Facebook. Now, he also acknowledged, and I quote, "We don't currently have a strong reputation for building privacy-protective services." He went on to also write, and I quote again, "I believe the future of communication will increasingly shift to private encrypted services where people can be confident that what they say to each other stays secure and their messages and content won't stick around forever. This is the future I hope we will bring about. We plan to build this the way we've developed WhatsApp," meaning when they bought WhatsApp, they got to developing, and that's what we're going to talk about. Now, Mr. Zuckerberg also said that the company was planning to apply to Instagram and Facebook Messenger end-to-end encryption. Now, if you're not familiar with what this is, it basically converts all of your messages into an encryption standard that essentially cannot be read by anybody except when it's unlocked and reaches its final destination. Meaning, if I send you a message on WhatsApp, it's encrypted on my phone, it's encrypted through the internet, and it's encrypted on your phone until you unlock it. Meaning, nobody can read this. WhatsApp messages are apparently so secure that not even Facebook can read this. Essentially read your messages, and that's exactly what Mark Zuckerberg said to a 2018 U.S. Senate in the hearing after the Cambridge Analytica basically scandal. And I quote, "We don't see any of the content in WhatsApp." Now, WhatsApp basically pounds this point home so frequently that it basically a message automatically appears on screen before you, the user, send a message, and I quote that message, "No one outside of this chat, not even WhatsApp, can read or listen to them," and that is blatantly false. WhatsApp has more than 1,000 contract workers, basically in office buildings in Austin, Texas, Dublin, Ireland, and Singapore, where they are examining millions of pieces of your WhatsApp content and everybody's WhatsApp content around the globe. Now, these workers are using special Facebook software to sift through streams of these private messages, images, and videos that have been reported basically by WhatsApp users to WhatsApp as improper, and then screened through the company's artificial intelligence systems. WhatsApp's director of communication, Carl Woog, acknowledged that the teams of contractors in Austin and elsewhere that review WhatsApp messages to identify and remove the worst abusers actually do exist. He acknowledged this. And here's the thing, though. This proves that they don't have end-to-end encryption in WhatsApp, because if they did, they wouldn't be able to read any of this. The company actually can and does read the messages that Mark Zuckerberg literally told the United States Senate that they couldn't see. He literally lied to Congress, and the WhatsApp director went on the record to admit that they actually do this. as reported by ProPublica. And this isn't the only way that Facebook has undone the privacy on their quote-unquote most secure platform. When WhatsApp was developed prior to it being purchased by Facebook, WhatsApp basically touted this as end-to-end, that WhatsApp wouldn't indeed see it. When Facebook absorbed this, they apparently have undone that. Now, many of the assertions by content moderators working for WhatsApp that ProPublica interviewed have basically confirmed, have had all of their accounts confirmed by a confidential whistleblower complaint filed last year with the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission. This is the SEC. Now, this complaint, which ProPublica also obtained, details WhatsApp's extensive use of outside contractors, artificial intelligence systems, and account information to examine messages, images, and videos that people are sending in WhatsApp. It alleges that the company's claims of protecting users' privacy are simply false. Quote, "We haven't seen this complaint," according to a Facebook spokesperson. The SEC has taken no public action on it, according to an agency spokesperson who declined to comment. Now, here's the thing. I have written and I have done videos and podcasts and even items on my own radio show about WhatsApp security. ProPublica has done an excellent reporting job here, but honestly, this shouldn't be news to anybody. We have known about WhatsApp issues for years, and I will give you this exact date here. On August 4th, 2019, I actually did one of my daily videos and podcasts and eventually put it on my radio show entitled, and I quote, "If you think WhatsApp is private and secure, think again." That video has thousands of views, for the record, because people are realizing that WhatsApp simply isn't secure and ProPublica proved it. Now, that video that I did talked about Facebook's plan to put an artificial intelligence, algorithm on your actual device, your iPhone or your Android, to basically scan messages from the WhatsApp app in your phone for basically content moderation. I talked about why in that I already thought that was in place. The mere fact that they are putting something there that allows them to see this is essentially important. And also, whoever owns the decryption keys, or owns rather the encryption keys, can decrypt a device. And if the establishment of encryption is being done by Facebook's infrastructure, there's no reason to say that they wouldn't be able to decrypt it and read the messages. And this is what we're seeing. When the message is on your phone and you have reported it, or even if you don't have to report it, they can actually pull that straight from there. And here we are. It's nice to be vindicated after 2 years after that. So understand, if you use WhatsApp, the privacy that you were promised is simply not there. And there are plenty of other competitors out there that do offer that. So for example, if you want an end-to-end secure messaging platform that is known good, it's actually run by a nonprofit, is Signal. Signal works on basically iPhone, it works on Android, and as far as we know, it is completely secure. They don't collect any information, and Signal is one of many. I'm not sitting here promoting them. There's plenty of those out there that you can go ahead and find. But WhatsApp, understanding Facebook's business model, is not as secure as they basically say it is. ProPublica proved that. And so if you're a WhatsApp user, you can't say you haven't been told.
For more from Nick Espinoza of Security Fanatic, see HuntleyRadio.com. More and more workers are forced to keep up a brutal pace and or take great risk to comply with algorithmically determined production schedules and, for drivers, routes. Steve Seltzer spoke to an Amazon driver in California and an Uber driver in Brazil.
This is Steve Seltzer with Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy, and we're talking with Adrienne Williams, an organizer and activist with Amazon. She fought for women workers and fought for better conditions, COVID health and safety conditions at Amazon. So welcome to our show.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that as a driver, you're not aware of the algorithms and you're not aware of how they're being used. So you never know. You're not aware of what your route is. You're not aware of what the expectation is on a daily basis. So to put it in perspective, if you think of a FedEx or UPS worker, they have a set route every day. They know their neighborhood. They know the route. They're able to troubleshoot if they know, like, okay, I know that these roads or these conditions are tough in a certain area. They're able to figure out ways in which to get around things or troubleshoot things. Amazon, you never know what you're going to come up against. And so you're never able to troubleshoot conditions or areas or neighborhoods. And so it makes it really dangerous, scary, difficult. And so I think that's the hardest part, because you can have, for instance, since there's no route designers in your region or your warehouse, all the route designers are in Seattle and they're not aware of your area. For instance, I could be put in the Sonoma Mountains at 9 p.m. in November during a storm. Now, if anybody knows that area, you know there are no actual roads, there are no lights, and those vans are humongous. So you potentially could just fall off a cliff. And if we had the ability to know those areas, you could plan your route accordingly and say, hey, I'm going to do that in the daytime where I can see and it would be safe. Or if they could plan a route, let's say, at Christmas time, and we were in neighborhoods that were a little sketchier, and we knew for a fact that people were getting robbed, they would put us in those neighborhoods again at Christmas time at 10 p.m. And we would tell our dispatchers, like, hey, we've been told by neighbors that people are getting robbed at gunpoint. And they could maybe put us to an Amazon locker instead of going straight to home. But they weren't willing to do that. And so in order to troubleshoot those things, if we were able to take control of our route instead of an algorithm, it would be safer and actually more cost effective, because you wouldn't be losing packages, you wouldn't be losing lives, but if you let an algorithm take control instead of a person.
And during the pandemic, you talked to people, you work with people, your steps each day, you were counting them. What happened as far as your work situation at Amazon, working there, stress that put on you and other workers?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, I was wearing a little Samsung watch. I was just curious to see exercise-wise how many steps I would get. Before the pandemic, I averaged about 5,500 to 6,000 steps, and I thought that was a good amount of exercise. And then after the pandemic, I was averaging between 10,000 and 11,000 steps, and you were still expected to do that within about 6.5 hours. I know when I started organizing, I felt like they were intentionally putting me in places. So when I started organizing, it was when I came back from homeschooling my daughter. So it was like in June, and it was in the summertime. I felt like they were always putting me in Vacaville, where it was triple digits, and they weren't paying attention to the heat illness prevention safety. And so it was triple digits. We were not allowed to stop our vans long enough for the AC to cool our vans down. So my van was hitting temperatures of 114, 15. I think the highest my van got to was like 122 degrees inside. And sometimes people would say, well, you have AC, don't you? And I'd be like, yeah, I have AC, but my stops are so close together. And in order for me to cool my van down, that would mean that I would have to actually stop long enough for my van to cool down. And I'm not allowed to do that. In order for me to do that, that would mean me taking time to do that, and that could mean my job. And you can't let your van idle while you deliver a package, because someone will steal your van, and that means you get fired. I actually got taken off my route one time by ambulance because I had heat stroke. I was throwing up so much on the side of the van, I had a customer have to call an ambulance for me because I caught heat stroke. And the doctor was scared to send me home because she was saying, we just gave you so much liquid, so many liquids in your IV, and your urine is still so dark, I'm afraid to send you home. You're so dehydrated. And she was like, you have to promise me that you continue to drink water when you go home because I'm afraid to send you home. You're so dehydrated. And apparently this is a big problem with the Amazon, because drivers are just not given any time. And she said, when you go back, I want you to look and see if there's any, like, there should be posted at your DSP or in the warehouse, there should be heat illness prevention posters. And I looked and I asked, I said, is there anything that says that we're allowed to stop, that we're allowed to take breaks? There was nothing anywhere. that said we're allowed to do that. And I think Amazon's probably laughing at that, because the bigger issue and the elephant in the room is who is going to enforce that? We have, what, like 100 OSHA representatives right now? They can't keep up with the violations. I called OSHA at one point when I was working there to report all of the safety violations. In order for our drivers to keep up with the pace, because here's the other thing about the algorithm. If I deliver, let's say I have 120 homes that I deliver to on a Tuesday, and I make that quota in 6 hours, then Wednesday they're going to give me 122 homes. Then on Thursday they're going to give me 124. Then Friday I'm 126, and it never stops. So in order to keep those quotas, drivers are breaking the speed limit. There's sensors in those vans. And so the sensors tell the dispatch and then Amazon, because Amazon is aware of everything the drivers do, the sensors tell Amazon whether you have your seatbelt on or not. So if you don't buckle your seatbelt, you get in trouble and can potentially get fired. But the time that it takes to both buckle and unbuckle your seatbelt at every stop is enough time to have you behind on your route. So every driver that I knew, including myself, and I'm ashamed to say it, would buckle our seatbelts behind our backs and have them buckled behind our backs for the entire route. So we were literally breaking the speed limit and driving without a seatbelt for the entire route, because the time it took to buckle and unbuckle our seatbelt was enough to have us behind.
We also talked with Brazilian Uber driver and organizer Wagner Oliveira about his experience with algorithms.
We are losing like 15 to 20 drivers every month. And we have favelas in here, and you guys don't have favelas over there. Some places are around the world, you don't have favelas, but we do have over here. And we're happy when Uber plots a straight line route to drive to take the passenger. And let's say the fare is going to cost $20. But if you go straight, you're going to go into the favela, right? So the drive.
Can you define favela?
Yeah, the village on the top of the mountain, poor people, criminals, armored, you know, very poor village. A lot of criminals, drug dealers living over there. So you can't go through because they don't allow you to go through because they think you are a police officer inside the car. So you have to shut your light down and then you have to open the windows and they have a gun and they want to see inside the car. So, and then after they check it out, you can go through. But it's very risky. So the drivers don't want to go straight on the Uber route. So they have to drive it around. If they drive it around, they are going to lose money because the trip is going to be 3 times bigger. So you have to choose and losing your life or losing money. If you reject the call, if you reject the ride, they kick you out the platform. So people getting, drivers getting shot almost every day in Rio, kidnapping and everything. So the algorithm, they are using the algorithm to commit crimes and they are hiding behind the algorithm because, you know, to make the algorithm work, you need a human being. So when they commit crimes, nobody's doing that. Who's responsible? The algorithm. That we have to kick Uber's door, handcuff them all and bring them behind bars because they are all criminals.
Wagner, what does Uber say when their drivers are killed in Brazil? What's their response to that?
They say that's a public problem to secure people. That's not their problem. And keep going and call the next driver. We got to keep driving. We got to keep working.
Labor journalist and researcher Mehmet Bayram talked with us about the role of capitalism and technology.
We have to understand that technology by itself is not an issue. The technology will only be successful and good for humans if it's in the hands of the people, not in the capitalist corporations. We know that the capitalist corporations right now, even as we speak, have technologies that we can't even fathom, but they have it. It's just their market strategy that will allow those devices or whatever they have created to come up. And they will never give it a chance unless marketing makes sense. It is like the medicine we have for diabetes. They can jack up the price 600%, or look at the fights that is going on with the vaccines. We have the technology. We can produce vaccines. We can save the whole world. But no, we are talking about prices. We are talking about licensing. We are talking while people in the world are dying.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Paulina Vasilia and me, Ann Garrison. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Paulina Vasilia, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.